Hello, welcome to episode 2 of the Parent Teacher Podcast, where we discuss topics that would be helpful to anyone who wants to help kids become successful adults, namely parents and teachers. I'm Casey, I'm your host, and today's key word is culpability. The definition of that is the responsibility for a fault or a wrong. It means blame or guilt. And the point is that when students lack the skills that they need and executive functioning, they can't really respond appropriately, and it can lead to negative consequences. So if you would like to see some related resources, including some tools to help them practice decision-making, you can check out my website and blog at reorientedadvocacy.com. And if you have a question or a concern you'd like to hear about related to school or parenting, you can contact me there, or I would love if you would leave a voice message at anchor.com. Today, my guest is Katrina Sifford, PhD. She's a professor at Elmhurst College in the Department of Philosophy, and her book is called Responsible Brains. Katrina focuses on executive function as the seat of responsible action. Her background is in law, but she has been focusing on criminal responsibility and moral culpability. All right, Katrina, thank you for coming. I think your background is very interesting. So you were a lawyer long ago, and now your focus has been on a lot of neurodiverse profiles and people. And then how did you go from focusing on law to focusing more on the psychology and culpability?
So I was a psychology major in undergrad, and I've always been interested in psychology. I went straight from undergrad to law school with the idea that I would focus on criminal law, because there's a link, obviously, between thinking about psychology and thinking about the grounds for which we hold people responsible, right? The sorts of psychologies you have to have in order to be fully responsible for an action. When I decided to go on and do the PhD, I wrote the PhD on psychology and the criminal law. So again, trying to articulate the sort of brain function that you have in order to be fully culpable for an action. And that led to me thinking about the sorts of ways in which your brain cannot ground responsible action, right? So the sorts of mental disorders, for example, that one might have that could ground legal insanity or a plea of legal insanity, or why we don't hold 7-year-olds responsible for their actions, for example. What's different about their brains than the brain of a person who we would hold fully responsible?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. And I, as we were talking initially, I said one thought I had from the education perspective is that frequently when we're dealing with behavior with students, whether it's a student who is eligible under the category of emotional disturbance or, you know, just a child acting out in school, one of the parts that we always discuss in the development of behavior intervention plans is a skill deficit versus a performance deficit. And I frequently will link back to Dr. Ross Green, who talks about can't versus won't. And from his perspective, everyone would do well if they can. And so can you share a little bit with me? I know you brought up some work recently or some observations about high functioning autism. And what is your perspective on can't, won't, and how our profiles neurologically impact behavior?
So there's two kind of groups that I'm interested in exploring from that perspective of can't and won't. One is juveniles generally. I think that the American criminal justice system has gotten it wrong, and that they think that oftentimes persons who make bad decisions when they're 15 or even 16 just won't do the right thing, when in reality, they can't, right? It's much harder for a juvenile, especially with kind of certain developmental background and certain living in certain environments, to make the right sort of choice. And this is because they don't have a fully developed prefrontal cortex. Mm-hmm. That is, they don't have robust executive functioning. So they're not just reckless because it's fun for them. They're reckless because it is much harder for them to take the time to be reflective about an action and to fully understand the consequences of their action. So in the book, we actually argue that no one should ever be held fully culpable under the age of 18. And maybe we should raise that age to 21, because those cognitive functions that are so important to kind of robust, responsible action are developing all the way up to 24 or to 26.
It seems like that's still developing. Like I've heard several numbers on that recently. I've heard also some studies on gender differences in prefrontal development. And I think that most people who are familiar with me would have a pretty basic understanding of executive function. But just to clarify, when I think of executive function in really the most basic sense, it's all of these higher order skills that you need for successful adulting. And that's really the whole point of education, right, is to raise and to educate successful adults. So some of the examples that might come up, for example, in a juvenile justice system would be things like inhibitory response, inhibitory control. So that impulsivity that we can often see in a classroom, or rigid thinking patterns, which I think just came up too. So can you talk a little bit about how different profiles might affect decision-making?
So there are wide range of executive profiles across neurotypicals, right? So some people are much more rigid in their thinking just naturally than others. Some people are more creative. Some people are more risky. Some people are more reflective. So there's a wide range, and that's because there are different executive functions, task switching, working memory, inhibition. And some people have strengths and weaknesses across different sorts of executive functions. So everyone has their own kind of profile. But then there are certain categories of person who are not considered neurotypical, who have certain types of executive deficits to some extent, right? And so we were talking about persons with high functioning persons with autism. It's such a heterogeneous class that we'll narrow ourselves to high functioning persons with autism. They tend to have rigid thinking. They have problem with task switching, so moving from one task to another, right? They're extreme rule followers. And that leads to certain sorts of moral strengths and moral weaknesses when it comes to choice making.
I also think of, there have been quite a few cases I've cited in the past of issues with law enforcement, right? Especially with autism, because there's also the sensory component and the overload. And that, again, inhibitory control, or, you know, just that it's also emotional regulation. But I know that there have been some efforts to train law enforcement to be more effective in dealing with people with disabilities or mental illness.
Yeah. So with high functioning persons with autism, what's interesting is they tend not to commit crimes. They tend to adhere to moral rules very strictly. They tend to be quite moral people. They really want to be included in the moral community. They care a lot about other people's feelings. They just have a hard time figuring out what those feelings are, right? And so we actually ought not to be overly worried about high-functioning persons with autism committing lots of crimes. They tend not to. However, when they do interact with law enforcement, it's pretty tricky, right? Because they do have these sensory integration problems. They have a hard time when other people exercise authority over them that they're not used to exercising authority over them. And they speak to them in these kind of rough authoritative ways and sometimes touch them when they ought not to be touching them. And unless law enforcement is trained in how to manage that particular population, what their strengths and weaknesses are with regard to kind of handling, especially novel situations, which high-functioning persons with autism have a hard time with, these novel situations, a new person, you know, that they've never dealt with before, they're going to make mistakes, and they're going to make mistakes that have very serious consequences sometimes. Mm-hmm. So it's really important that we start training law enforcement across the kind of, not just in how to handle a neurotypical, but across the different sorts of cognitive types.
Yeah. And then I'll bring it back to, from the education lens, you know, I brought up before that typically if a student has, and I think often when we think of behavior, we think of externalizing behavior, especially in schools. Often the kids with, when I say externalizing, I mean acting out or defiant behavior, disruptive behaviors. You know, it looks like losing your temper. It looks like flipping your lid. And that often we associate that with things like oppositional defiant disorder, ADHD particularly in boys. And then there's also internalizing behaviors, which are a little harder, I think, to address from an outside perspective. What would be helpful for teachers to know or for parents to know then about how to educate or how to fill in some of these skill gaps for someone who, let's start with, is a rigid thinker?
So I think the first thing is to be an advocate for your child with regard to their own sort of cognitive strengths and weaknesses, right? If you know that they are maybe overly rigid rule followers, but also that they are rigid followers of moral rules, so they're likely to tell the truth, right? Mm-hmm. Even though they have a hard time in novel situations, you can portray that to the educator as strengths and weaknesses. You need to understand the strengths and weaknesses of my child, right? And then there are actually ways in which you can strengthen those weak points in executive functions, right? I have a high functioning autist in my honors ethics class this term, actually. And he was saying, you know, he considers himself extraordinarily moral, but he understands that sometimes he has a hard time applying the moral rules he takes very seriously to situations when other people are feeling something, because he has a hard time understanding their feelings. And so he has learned to apply an explicit rule of asking. I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're feeling. Can you tell me?
Oh, that's really smart.
And so he can avoid hurting someone's feeling or making them uncomfortable by saying, I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're feeling. Can you tell me?
Right.
And then that person has an obligation to be honest with that person, to not be put off by the question, even though it might seem odd. But they have to meet halfway then and say, you're making me uncomfortable because you're standing too close. Then he says, if someone will say that, I'm happy to step back.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Because he wants to do the right thing. So the person that has the deficit has to learn how to maybe accommodate or correct for it. But then we as society have to meet them halfway.
Right.
We have to give them the information they need, and we have to not be uncomfortable in the way in which they are correcting.
Yeah, I think that it really falls into my definition of advocacy, which is the very first step is self-awareness. The very first step always is successfully identifying strengths and areas of weakness. And I often think of it as short-term and long-term, because there are some things we can overcome with time and practice. And then there are some things that I feel aren't fixed, but are always going to be a little more challenging. So for example, often when I meet people, I know in myself, my working memory is a real area of weakness. It just always has been. I said I've jokingly called myself the absent-minded professor since I was a child, because it's like an out-of-body experience, right? Where I have a thought in my head. And so I advocate for myself by being a clear, I'm communicating clearly my need. Like, please hold on. I know you're starting to speak, but I'm going to have to write down everything that you say, or I'll forget what I'm doing.
Exactly. Neurotypicals, as we're called, right, also can identify our strengths and weaknesses, and we correct them all the time. We keep lists, right? We use our phones as external memory devices. And we have to just understand that our students that have strengths and weaknesses have to learn to identify those things, as you said, and then to learn to try and ask people to help them, you know, scaffold them up so that they can act in a way that is conducive to their education and to getting along with everybody that's around them. When juveniles generally, by the way, you know, that especially young boys are more impulsive. They're mm-hmm. risk takers. Mm-hmm. You know, as parents, instead of saying, don't do that, which is not help at all.
Right.
We can teach them, okay, look, you need to slow down. I know this seems super fun and it probably would be totally awesome. But if, you know, the pros and cons are, this is going to be totally awesome and fun, and I'm going to look great to my friends, but I might be killed. Mm-hmm. You have to learn to weigh the might be killed part against the awesome fun part. And you have to teach them, because there's been studies that have shown that each of those consequences weighs exactly the same to a young male. And if there's two awesome things and one I might die, the two awesome things outweigh the I might die.
Yeah, that's good.
And so as parents, we have to say, no, the I might die one needs to outweigh the awesome things. You have to slow down. You have to think that through, right?
Right.
And if you can train them to slow down and think that through and to start weighting it, right? They can get a little bit better. It's slow over time.
And I think that this isn't new knowledge. We've always known, right? Teens are risk takers. In fact, they've changed the laws around driving to reflect that. That's a really good example. The new research, I think the surprising part for a lot of parents is, like we said, it's not that at 18 you're an adult. It extends further than this, which, you know, we know. And I think that really when we think of breaking these things down, things like the rule, the rigid thinking, I think that I can see a workaround for that, that you could see the payoff of, I think, of sentence starters or using a script, right? Giving kids the language in which to speak. I think the really tough one is the emotional regulation. And so the other thing that you brought up when we first started was talking about the justice system. And the other thing that we know really affects emotional regulation and impulsivity, especially in terms of the aggression, like aggressively acting out, is trauma, which can't be discounted or separated sometimes, I think, from the neurodiverse profiles. So do you know, have you ever come across effective training or interventions for kids who like act out, who act quickly?
Yeah. So the studies I've seen that have worked with juvenile offenders that have really tried to attack the emotional regulation problems have found that the best sort of results come from really traditional like CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy programs, where the child gets one-on-one attention with the therapist, where they're invited to really express their trauma, to kind of delve into it deeply in a safe space. And they're taught those techniques for handling the things that trigger them so that they can slow down, identify them, understand that they're triggering them, and work through it slowly. It's time consuming, it's expensive work, but it seems to be one of the only things that has an effect on the child's ability to manage that emotional regulation.
Yeah, I think you hit on the two things I was holding in my head, which is one, it takes a long time. And I think of, you know, when you're working with a younger child, especially when we talk about ADHD, people have often talked about this, this delay, right, in emotional intelligence. And I would say it's not emotional intelligence. The intelligence is there. It's the regulation that is really the culprit for a lot of the behavior. And so some of it is just waiting for that maturity to set in. The other thing, I really like cognitive behavioral therapy, and I think I've heard of a few programs that really bring it down to a child's level, in that anyone can name and understand some of these cognitive distortions or mind traps. Is, you know, I feel like I can talk to my 8-year-old about how you're being really rigid right now. Like, you're really seeing this as black and white. But I think that even if you thought of it this way, you can identify at least one positive of this negative situation, or you can identify like one negative of that positive situation. So I think, you know, it's relatable.
I think so. I think it can work for young kids, but you're right. It's hard work. It takes time, and it takes a real investment in the child's well-being. And with juvenile offenders, you know, what's unfortunate is that we are just not willing to invest that time and effort in those juvenile offenders. So oftentimes they've had serious trauma, they have major emotional regulation problems, and they're not going to grow out of it naturally until they're in their late 20s, right? Until they've really had, they're fully developed cognitively and they have their time. So we need to invest in them more. We need to offer them that one-on-one help. We need to show them that the system cares about them as an individual and isn't just trying to deter them from some future act.
I think I can relate this again too in thinking about from the context of behavior plans or working with students who are struggling with some of these skills in school. I think that the success or the perceived success of any goal setting and intervention that we would do really depends on how we pace it and that we have a realistic expectation. And I often tell parents when we're talking about an IEP, you know, we write an annual goal, which is always our best estimate of how much progress we can realistically make in 1 year, and that can really vary, but that we could really sabotage kids if we're setting the bar so high that they really don't think that they're capable of meeting expectations. And I'll bring it back to, again, Ross Green's statement of kids do well when they can, and I would say kids do well when they think they can.
Yeah, I mean, I teach college students, and I see college students who are still working through some of their deficits and trying to accommodate them and understand how to best kind of parlay them into success at the college level. And it's at that point, some of them think, I'm in college now. I should be done with this work. I don't need an IEP anymore. I don't need accommodations anymore. I'm done with the work. And I have to say to them, you're never done with work.
No.
Neurotypicals are never done with the work. Right. Again, a lot of this is on something like a bell curve, right, where neurotypicals also have deficits and problems and our own cognitive signatures with our own limitations where we have to write lists to remember stuff or whatever. The work is never finished. You may not be categorized as having special needs anymore, but you still have special needs like everybody has. Mm-hmm. And if you know yourself and your own cognitive capacities, you continue working on them for the rest of your life.
Yeah, that whole concept of being a lifelong learner. I mean, I joke with almost everyone I run into who have stated brilliant things. They have interesting perspectives, and it's still, what do you want to be when you grow up? Like, we're still developing self-awareness. And to bring it back to the point of advocating for yourself, it can take a long time before you even develop that self-awareness of like, oh, if this little accommodation is in place, even as an adult, then I can be successful. And I think teaching kids that growth mindset, I'll use the word, it crops up over and over, but that, you know, it's never fixed. And that we should view these things from a short-term and long-term perspective, which brings me back again to when we talk about parenting children or raising successful adults. I think of the recent focus on executive function and how it's become a term more and more people are familiar with. A lot of teachers are interested or training, they're informed on this. And like you said, you work with college students, and I have that experience as well. And sometimes it's a bit surprising, like, okay, it's hard still to make a plan to prioritize. And so a word that came up before we started recording was scaffolding. So any thoughts on how we set this up as, fading support over time?
Yeah. So I'm surprised at the level of maturity of some of my college students in the process of developing that kind of top-down cognitive control where they're making long-term plans and little short-term goals to get to the long-term plan and reflecting upon that long-term goal. Do they really want it? Right? All of this deliberative, conscious planning, they're still having a hard time developing that skill at the college level. And I think it's partly because some of the students that I'm seeing have not been given robust choices across a wide range of things coming to my classroom. So we really want to make sure that we set our students up for success, right? And our kids up for success by not giving them choices where they're going to fail terribly at them. But we want to give them an expanding range of choices, right? Where they're really deliberating about whether they want to do X or Y, and they understand what the consequences of X versus Y are, and they're choosing X or Y, and then they're feeling what happens from doing X or Y, and taking that feedback into working memory, into their long-term memory and working memory, so they can make a different choice next time, or maybe the same choice again. This process is really important. And when kids have their lives kind of tracked for them, where they're really very scheduled and they're really not making lots of choices about what to do with their time or what sorts of classes to take or what sorts of things that they want to do, they're not getting a lot of practice at that sort of top-down cognitive decision-making that's going to be so important when they're on their own in college.
Right. I think of opportunity cost, right? Like, I can go on, but it's interesting how different brains think different ways. And I think of goal-oriented persistence, or the ability to put off gratification, for example, is something that really you only gain better perspective on that by making mistakes or weighing choices.
Exactly. We need to allow our children to make mistakes so that they understand that this decision led to that mistake, and then they want to make that decision differently the next time. If we don't allow them to fail, they're never going to have that kind of knowledge in their system so that they can reflect upon a similar choice in the future. When they're on their own and you're not there to make that choice with them.
Right, right. And there are a lot of opportunities for us to set up safe situations for practice, low stakes situations for practice.
Exactly. You know, someone that I know that's been working with juveniles in a juvenile detention center makes choices with regard to rewards, right? So if you get a reward, you have a range of choices with regard to the reward. And it's a real choice. You don't get both. Mm-hmm. You don't get to pick one and then get both. Which one do you want? Do you want this candy bar? Do you want this 15 minutes of a screen, whatever? Do you want this thing? And they make the choice and they're stuck with it.
Yeah. Oh, right? Yeah.
And even that little tiny choice has huge ramifications for the person feeling their agency, feeling the ramifications of expressing that agency, and then thinking about how they want to make the choice the next time.
Yeah. And I've seen this in action in, say, a classroom where you're working with kids who may be going through ABA, I am working for, and you present them with three separate reinforcers. They choose one, which also builds communication, which is great. I've seen this at the middle school level. You may present a class with a choice of four separate graphic organizers before you give a lecture, ask them to take notes on a chapter, and then have them reflect on, was that the best format? Does that help you organize your thinking? That's another low stakes. Budgetary choices at home, giving an allowance. I really do advocate for giving your kids a meaningful allowance, which sounds like more money than I think a lot of people want to give these days. But the truth is, you know, $1 doesn't get you very far anymore.
Right. Enough money so that you have choices to make with it, right? Mm-hmm. Are you going to blow it? Are you going to save it? Are you going to do this or that with it? And then they feel the ramifications of making that choice. You can do that with chores too, right? You have to do some chores. Do you want to do this one or that one?
Yep.
Right. Because then when you choose it, you own it in a way. Instead of you have to X, do you want to X or Y?
So I think you're saying I should feel good when my child is angry that they made the wrong choice and they're kind of muttering about it.
Exactly. Because in a way, then they're owning that choice. They're reflecting on that choice. They're thinking about, okay, maybe I'm not happy with this choice. Do I have an option for that choice next time? Then they'll do that choice and they'll realize, oh, wait, that's actually worse than this one.
Right.
Right. But they're learning how to exercise that prefrontal cortex. It's so important. It's really the more you use that deliberative choice making, the better you become at it.
So I'm going to go to our takeaway. And I think we just kind of covered it. It really seems to be that choice making is going to be the thing that really strengthens these executive functioning skills, even into adulthood. And I would argue, even as an adult, still having a variety of choices is going to make people capable of making better decisions.
Yes, it's so important, even as an adult. And we've found that when we put persons in solitary confinement, where we deny them choice altogether, they suffer in a psychological way that's so severe, because the human brain, even the adult human brain, needs to exercise a meaningful choice making in order to kind of, for a person to feel like they're a person. That matters.
Fascinating. And I think the implications of that for parents and for teachers is pretty clear.
And then to know your strengths and weaknesses when it comes to choice making, right? Everybody has strengths and weaknesses, whether you're considered a neurotypical or non-neurotypical.
Right.
To know those strengths and weaknesses and then to work on the weaknesses and enjoy the strengths.
So also I think of not just choices, but also maybe promoting systems. I think of things that I use, like the planner, where you reflect on it when things go wrong and you say, where did this break down? What happened here? And then you can identify that skill. And in a lot of cases, like we said, it's not something you're going to just teach and they're going to get it overnight. It may be something you need to put in place long-term as a support for yourself. It may be something you need to be able to state clearly to people as a need. You may need to tell your college professor, I need you to write the assignment on the board.
Right. Or I need to record this lecture because I have a hard time in real-time note-taking, you know, or I need you to tell me, if you're talking to a friend, how you're feeling or what's happening with you in this way, in order for me to make the best choices about helping you. All of those things come from knowing your strengths and weaknesses and then kind of accommodating your own kind of cognitive capacities.
Makes sense to me. I think that is it for today. Thank you so much. That was really helpful.
Thank you.